Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. What do St. Louis and the Central American country of Belize have in common? Unfortunately, some things that neither is happy about. We'll have more on that a little bit later. But first, living below the poverty line is difficult enough, but trying to survive on $2 a day would seem all but impossible. Those who do anything they can to survive. That often means crossing legal, moral, and ethical lines. Our guest on today's program paints a very vivid picture of this $2-a-day lifestyle in his book, $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. H. Luke Schaefer co-wrote it with Catherine Eden, and it's the product of extensive research. Luke Schaefer is also associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Social Work and the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy. Luke, thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Having read your book, it's really an eye-opener to a lot of us, I'm sure, but it really breaks the point that there is poverty and that there's extreme poverty, and those are the folks you're talking about.
That's right. In fact, we didn't go looking for this group of people. It really came through my colleague, my co-author's research. She's an ethnographer, which means she spent her career going and talking to people and getting to know them and getting to know their circumstances. And a few years ago, she was back in the field and felt like she was going into more and more homes where people didn't just have not enough to live on. They had virtually nothing at all. And she wondered, was this a trend? She'd been doing this work for 20 years and hadn't seen anything like this at the scale she was seeing it in her career. And so that's when we partnered with each other. She shared her insights with me, and I went to the best nationally representative data that's available, and it's not perfect data. No data source is, but it's a survey of tens of thousands of households all around the United States, and that's where we made this, I think, surprising discovery to us that there were, in any given month, about 1.5 million households with 3 million children, and that's just households with children surviving below this level of cash income of $2 per person per day.
You do it through case studies, and you bring to us a lot of people who are living in this situation. Is the $2 a day an arbitrary number that you came up with, or is it literally $2 a day?
Yeah, as I tell my students, whenever you need some sort of arbitrary threshold, we were interested in, were there people living on virtually nothing, as we say in the title, and the $2 a day threshold is one that the World Bank uses to measure extreme poverty. Now, they prefer worldwide in what's called a consumption measure, where you try to sort of take all the resources someone has. In our book, we really focus both on consumption, but also just on the importance of cash in the United States. Imagine even if you had a benefit like food stamps that's not cash, but you could access some amount of food, what it would be like to go from day to day in the most advanced capitalist economy with no cash income at all to buy things like underwear or a bus ticket to get to a job interview. And, mm-hmm. and we think that there's a certain salience to cash in this country that maybe isn't as important in some of the world's poorest countries where there's a very thriving barter economy.
Mm. Well, we'll get to the food stamps and other things in a little bit later because they actually sell those food stamp coupons in order to raise some of that cash. But, you know, we have a welfare system in this country. But you point out very clearly in the beginning of your book that welfare ain't what it used to be.
Yeah. In the 1990s, we actually made a lot of landmark changes. It was a period of extreme change in what we provide to poor families with children. And I think a lot of people don't realize the extent of the change. And some of that was very good. There's programs like the Earned Income Tax Credit, which takes whatever you earned at a low-wage job and actually supplements that considerably. And we spend a lot of money on that, and it's actually a fairly popular program, and we have some good evidence that it works. And a program like food stamps is still critical, and you can actually see in the data what a buffer it does provide to poor families. But in 1996, there was a welfare law that dramatically changed the nature of our cash assistance program, what a lot of people think of as welfare. And the effect of that has been to really make that program a shell of its former self. And with many of the people who we met, when we met Travis and Jessica Compton in Johnson City, Tennessee, they'd been surviving on no income, nothing coming into the house for about 3 months. And in fact, the only income they got is from Jessica selling her blood plasma as much as the law will allow, which brings in about $55 a week. And they have two little kids, Rachel and Blythe. And when we asked, have you thought about applying for TANF, this cash welfare program, temporary assistance for needy families? And they said, what's that? In a lot of places around the country, it's been so uncommon that people don't even know it exists. Mm-hmm. And the way that the program was designed is such that actually states have a direct incentive to keep people off those rolls. And if they do, they actually get to use the money for other things. So in some ways, it's become a welfare program for states rather than people.
But these people have to know that those programs are out there. And as you indicate, frequently they don't.
Yeah, exactly. From Madonna Harris in Chicago, who had worked for 7 years as a cashier at a music store. When we asked her, had you thought about applying for TANF, she had lost her job and had been living in a succession of family homeless shelters, has nothing in the kitchen at all on the day we met with her. And she says, oh, haven't you heard? They're just not giving that out anymore. Mm-hmm. So there's this perception out there that it doesn't exist. In other cases, we hear from people who actually did go in and try to get assistance and were sort of routed away from it, if you will, by caseworkers. So Ray McCormick in Cleveland, Ohio, had actually worked as a cashier at Walmart for 6 months, had been named cashier of the month twice in that period, and for various reasons had lost her job, which we can talk about later if you like. And she really didn't want to go in. She doesn't like the cash welfare program. But finally, she went out of desperation, and a caseworker told her, oh, honey, there's just not enough. There's so many needy people. There's just not enough to go around. Come back next year.
Hard to imagine. Why is it, do you think, Luke, that so many of these people in the country just despise welfare? They hate the notion of it. They think it's contrary to the American values?
Yeah. This is a really important question and one we spend a lot of time and we write about in the book. I think that anytime you have a government policy, you want it to be in line with American values. And in the welfare program itself, the way it was before the welfare change in 1996, really wasn't in a lot of ways. It was cash. It was help for doing nothing. And in fact, if you ask Americans, should we do more to help the poor? Generally, across surveys, a large majority will say, yes, yes, we should do more to help the poor. But if you ask them, should we spend more on welfare? A majority will say no. And so the program we had before, and Kathy and I want to be very clear about this, that was not a popular program. It wasn't well liked by the recipients. Mm-hmm. When you ask the folks in our book, when we would ask them, you know, if we come back in a year and you were doing better, you were really sort of making it, what would it look mm-hmm. like? To a person, they would always say, I'd have a job. I'd have a decent job with stable hours that pays $11 to $12 an hour. Welfare doesn't sort of enter into the picture. I think because it's just gone against these core American values, it just ends up being very unpopular with the American public, with policymakers, and with the people who receive the assistance.
It's getting some attention during this political season. I wonder if that presages any potential change. What do
yeah.
you think?
Well, in our opinion, we need a functioning cash safety net in this country. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if TANF, the program we have right now, temporary assistance for needy families, if it functioned like we had intended it to function, I think it might actually do the trick. It's a program that does have lifetime limits, and there's work requirements for folks who are able-bodied, you know, able-bodied parents. But the way it was designed, actually, the failure of TANF is in the sort of the nitty-gritty of the policy and the mm-hmm. fact that it was structured as a block grant that the federal government says, here's a chunk of money and you can use it for cash assistance, this program that virtually nobody likes, but we really probably think in this country we need something. But you don't have to use it for that. And if you don't have people on the program, you can use the money for other stuff. So this creates this perverse incentive to really keep their caseloads down and spend the money on other things.
The two political parties today couldn't be farther apart on this.
We've been surprised. We spent a lot of time in Washington, and I've just been surprised on the extent to which this particular issue, you know, we've heard a lot about inequality, I think, but really trying to tackle what's going on with the poorest American families, it just hasn't been on the political agenda. And so there hadn't been all that much thought on TANF. But I think you're absolutely right that, you know, if a debate were to happen, there would be a very sharp divide. Although I do think there's some things in the book that we talk about where there could be a lot of consensus, and that's around expanding economic opportunity.
We'll talk more about that. We have to take a break now. My guest in studio is Luke Schaefer. He is the co-author of $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. And there are many, many households who live just that way. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Luke Schaefer, co-author of $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. By the way, Luke's going to be part of Empower Missouri's annual conference on poverty and inequality, separating fact from fiction, tomorrow and Friday at the Holiday Inn Executive Center in Columbia, Missouri. You'll be speaking tomorrow. Is that correct, Luke?
That's right, yeah, okay. At the lunch hour.
Something for folks in that area or even from here to be thinking about attending. Mm-hmm. But before we continue this conversation, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. St. Louis County Executive Steve Stenger announced today that he wants to institute new minimum police training standards for all police departments in the county. Stenger says if his bill is approved, it would create equality for all residents. St. Louis Metropolitan Police are investigating the city's 160th homicide of the year. That surpasses the total number of murders in the city for all of 2014. Authorities say a man in his mid-40s was shot several times and was found this morning at Goodfellow and Page Boulevards. And Missouri's Education Department says it's removing schoolchildren's Social Security numbers from its state database. The department, in an audit report released today, mentioned it will stop the practice by the end of June 2016. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. And Luke Schaefer, having read that story about kids' Social Security numbers, reminds me of a section of your book in which you talk about these people that we're talking about, the $2 a day people, mm-hmm. sell their kids' Social Security numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think when we started with this question of does a little bit of cash matter to make it at the very bottom of American society, the best proof of that was the work, the incredible work that the families we met spent trying to generate just that, just enough cash to bring their families, you know, to the next day, whether it is to stay in their apartment for one more month before they get evicted or get their kid in decent clothes that they got at the thrift store, which you can't pay for with, you know, in-kind benefits like food stamps. And to generate that cash, we saw just a very wide range of, you might even call it entrepreneurial or innovative activity. There was very much an American spirit sort of in this regard of taking what resources they had and just trying to make the most of it. So Jessica Compton, as I said, she's a short woman in Johnson City, Tennessee, sells her blood plasma twice a week. We're actually the only nation in the world that allows people to sell their blood plasma twice in 1 week because other countries have health concerns about it. But for her, it's the way to generate enough cash. And as she's going, she's always worried, is my iron level going to be high enough that I'll be allowed to have somebody stick a needle in my arm? And actually, when you look at her arm, there's a little divot inside the crease of her her elbow from giving so much. But we also saw selling of SNAP was fairly common.
That's the food stamps.
That's food stamps, exactly. And the way this usually works is somebody might go into a grocery store where they know or have heard this activity happens, and the grocer might actually swipe through $100 of fake groceries, let's say, and And then the groceries don't exist, but it gets charged $100, and then the grocer would give the person $60 back in cash. And your listeners can tell the problem right there. First of all, this is a felony. It's against the against the law to sell large amounts of your food stamps, and quite punishable very severely. But also, the families lose 40% of their purchasing power, because that 40% is sort of the, you know, the grocer's
take.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so you see the extent to which just a little bit of cash makes a big difference to families. Now, with Social Security numbers, we actually didn't see that very common, but we did see instances with these tax credits, like the earned income tax credit, that you can only get if you work. That's why it's very popular, but it's also not a safety net, right? It doesn't mm-hmm. if you lose your job, you also lose the benefit. And we saw a very limited case where a family in the Mississippi Delta, the by far the poorest place that we were, would sell a childless couple. You have to have a child to get this credit, the Social Security number, and then they would split the refundable tax credit, which could be a couple thousand dollars.
You have to give them credit for being resourceful and finding anything they can in order to make a buck, including selling their bodies.
Yep. Yeah, we saw a fair amount of this, and it doesn't look like, you know, street prostitution that you might think of, but it would often just be sort of engaging in sex for the ability to stay at a guy's house for a couple nights and keep a roof over your child's head. Or in a lot of cases, we found families' only connection, their only chance of getting a job, is if they kept their cell phone on. And so in some cases, we might see sort of this trading of sex for somebody who might pay their cell phone bill for a month or two.
Incredible. Let's take a call. We have Jay, who wants to get into the conversation and talk about kids, I believe. He's in Normandy. Jay, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. And again, these are tough stories about selling plasma and all that stuff. But one thing I always wonder about welfare, and a lot of associates that I know make pretty negative comments about it, because one, the people sit at home, don't do anything. But the thing I'd be concerned about, are there really incentives or are extra payouts for having more and more children? You know, if you're trying to make it on your own with jobs, you know, you realize, well, we can't afford 4 and 5 kids. But we hear about, or think we see examples of single women having 4 and 5 kids and on welfare, sitting at home and not working. What's the truth there?
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jay.
Yeah, I can't say that these examples don't exist. I think it's easy for us to sort of find one example of a family with a large number of children, and it almost lets us off the hook for the structural problem. And for that one family, there might be 5, 10, 20 families that only have 1 or 2 kids. And when you look at the data, you don't actually see a lot of evidence that sort of the number of children is driving it. Now, with TANF, most families aren't on TANF. And again, there's lifetime limits for the ones who are. But there's not a lot of reason to think it drives that behavior. Now, with SNAP, with a program like food stamps, you do get a little bit more. But most people on food stamps still run out of money by the end of the month, and they're not eating. So I can't really think of it as a significant incentive to sort of keep people at home. And plus, you can't pay for your rent if you do. But I think your question really gets to what the families who we talk to want. And as I said, none of them point to going back to the old welfare system as what they want. What they really want is economic opportunity. And what was really striking was the extent to which we would see somebody like Jennifer Hernandez apply for 40 or 50 jobs in a month and really bust her tail to find work. It's extremely difficult, especially in the low-wage labor market, to find a job. And then the quality of the jobs that they get are leave something very serious to be desired. So Jennifer Hernandez had 2 kids, again, Caitlin and Cole, who they'd been living in a succession of family homeless shelters in the city of Chicago. She was about to be asked to leave the one she was in because if you don't find a job over a certain amount of time, you're asked to move on. And she landed a job at Chicago City custodial services, a small family cleaning company on the south side of Chicago. And at first, she really liked the job. And she'd talk about how, you know, she'd like the opportunity to go in and they'd be cleaning corporate apartments between rentals or office space. And, you know, there's something she found very fulfilling about the structure and the ability to see, you know, she'd come in and it was dirty and she'd leave. And there was a sense of accomplishment there. A lot of what I think many of us like about our jobs. But in that particular job, as the Chicago winter set in and it got colder and colder, she found she was cleaning more and more foreclosed homes on the south side of Chicago particularly. These were homes that had been shuttered for a long time. There was no heat. There was no there were no lights, so she'd be cleaning in the dark with her team, and there was no water. So when the water would get pitch black after maybe half an hour, 45 minutes, they'd have to go up and dump it out and go up to the nearest neighbor's, you know, if they had an outdoor faucet or the nearest gas station and refill and go back. And she ended up starting to get sick, and she had asthma, and she would have some attacks. And eventually she said, you know what, I need to quit this job and get well. Her hours were ticking down, and this is a huge problem for folks at the very bottom that, you know, you might be able to find a job, but can you find a job that offers more than 15, 20, 25 hours? You know, this makes a big difference if you're working at 8, 25 an hour. You know, she knew it had taken 10 months to find that job, right? 10 months to find a job cleaning foreclosed homes. You go in, you don't know, is there family squatting in there? Is a drug den? Has everything been ripped out of the walls? And so it's clear to me, I think a primary policy initiative has to be around work and expanding the opportunity to work. Because if we said to Jennifer Hernandez, we're going to guarantee you a job, maybe it's a job improving the infrastructure, she would take that in a heartbeat over sitting at home getting a welfare check.
Of course, you've got to be hired first. And you, you point out in the book, a number of people, you know, they can't dress as well as they would like to for a job interview. You mentioned one woman who had lost teeth, and this presentation was not really inducive for being hired.
Yeah, so it is a labor market and continues to be a labor market for folks at the bottom that companies often have a lot of candidates, you know, for these low-skilled jobs. And if you have someone like Jennifer Hernandez who has some very noticeable gum problems in her mouth, it's you know, when you first meet her, it's a little sort of striking, a little hard to look at. And her address is at a family homeless shelter. You know, that right there marks a certain instability. You know, what employer is not going to just go on to the next person, which is, I think, where some sort of government public-private partnership needs to intervene there. And maybe we partner with employers and say, hey, if we pay a certain percentage of the wage, you know, will you take a chance on someone like Jennifer Hernandez and see if we could expand the number of jobs available?
Has the number of people in this category you write about increased? Is it increasing?
Yeah, so when we look at this, the number of families below this $2 per person per day threshold, it more than doubles over the last 15 years. We sort of mark 1996 when we made this landmark change as our starting point. And so it's really on the rise. And when we looked a little bit deeper, we see that it's actually not short spells that people are experiencing a month or 2 months like this. That's happening too. But what's really grown is the number of families who are in this 7, 8, 9, 12 months during a calendar year. So they're either in it for a long period or it's a recurring spell. You know, you get a job and you get out of it like Jennifer Hernandez does, and then you inevitably sort of fall back into it.
Only got about 45 seconds left. If it weren't for some of the shelters that are out there and some of the charities that are out there, it's really hard to imagine how these people could literally survive.
Yeah, that's right. And so in that way, I think our private charitable sector is playing a critical role in putting a house over the, you know, a roof over a lot of families and kids' heads, and I really want to commend them in that work. One thing we did see is that those resources are not equally spread out around the country. So in a place like Chicago, there's more opportunities to get help. In a place like Cleveland, a little bit less so. In a place like Johnson City, a little less so. In the Mississippi Delta, There's nothing at all.
We've got to leave it at that point. Luke Schaefer, thanks so much for being with us. The name of the book is $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. Luke will be at the Empower Missouri Annual Conference tomorrow in Columbia, Missouri. Thanks so much for being with us. Good luck with the book.
Thanks for having me.
It's a very interesting read. Thanks.